On this week's 51%, the Arizona State Supreme Court has cleared the way for the revival of an abortion ban dating back to the 1860s. Rutgers Law School professor Kimberly Mutcherson breaks down the court's decision.
There are a lot of moving pieces, and the abortion law in Arizona is going to be in flux for some time to come.
NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon also gets personal in her new book, The Ex-Vangelicals. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh leader. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. Earlier this month, the Arizona State Supreme Court upheld a long-dormant 1864 law banning nearly all abortions in the state. The law, which actually predates the state, doesn't make any exceptions for pregnancies caused by rape or incest, and only allows abortions in cases where the life of the mother is at risk. The move has sparked both excitement and outrage from stakeholders in Arizona and beyond, depending on where you stand. As of this taping, Republicans in the Arizona legislature have repeatedly blocked attempts to repeal the law before it can go into effect. Arizona is one of 21 states that has moved to either ban or heavily restrict abortion since the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022. The Iowa Supreme Court also heard arguments this month for a case that could effectively ban abortion in that state at the six-week mark. Here to help us better understand it all is Kimberly Mutcherson. Mutcherson is an award-winning professor and former co-dean at Rutgers Law School in Camden, New Jersey, where her work has largely focused on reproductive justice, bioethics, and family and health law. Kimberly, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So I guess maybe just to start out, let's talk a little bit more about this law in Arizona. What exactly does this law say?
Yeah. So basically, like a lot of states, Arizona had laws on the books about abortion that existed before Roe versus Wade in 1973. And like a lot of states, Arizona kept those laws on the books even after Roe versus Wade made those laws unconstitutional. So now that Dobbs has happened, where the Supreme Court made the decision in 2022 to reverse Roe, all of these states that have these statutes that they never repealed are trying to figure out what to do with them. Now, some states actually had what are called trigger bans, and those were statutes that said as soon as Roe versus Wade gets overturned, we are banning or severely restricting abortion in our jurisdictions. Arizona didn't do that. So it has this law on the books that's been there since 1864, but then it also has more current laws that create a 15-week ban on abortion. So really what's going on here is trying to figure out whether those two laws can coexist, whether that first law from 1864 can be enforced at all, or what's going to happen in terms of the legality of abortion in Arizona.
I mean, if they were to coexist, how exactly would that happen? Because, you know, it sounds like one completely trumps the other.
Yeah, and that's basically what the Arizona Supreme Court said, that the two of them can't exist together. There were some arguments that were being made that, you know, you could still have the 15-week ban, but you could have some of the elements of the 1864 law. But as you said, they don't really work in conjunction with each other because the law from 1864 bans all abortion except in cases of preserving the life of the pregnant person. So not even a health exception, not a rape exception, not an incest exception. And then for people who perform abortions under that 1864 law, that's a criminal act and you could spend 2 to 5 years in prison for doing that. So the Arizona Supreme Court said basically, we've got this law on the books. It was never repealed. If the legislature wants to change the law, wants to do something about it, then they have to act. The Arizona Supreme Court wasn't going to do it for them.
And does the Arizona legislature want to act? You know, what does the future of this issue look like there?
Well, there are a lot of things that happened pretty quickly after that decision was made by the state Supreme Court. So first of all, they stayed their decision for 14 days. So they said, you know, we're not going to say that the law goes into effect until 14 days after that decision. So that would be next week, I guess, that it could go into effect. But there have been other pieces of litigation in Arizona, which have led some people to argue that even if it's going to go into effect, it couldn't go into effect until, you know, maybe June or so, because of other litigation that's going on in Arizona. So it's not even clear if the decision of the Arizona Supreme Court does stand, it's not even clear when that law would go into effect. So there's lots of confusion going on there. And then in addition to that, you've got the state legislature, which has been forced basically to figure out what are we going to do here? And since the decision, there have already been two attempts to get the legislature to repeal that 1864 law, and those attempts have been blocked by Republicans in the legislature. They are the majority in the Arizona legislature right now. So even though the majority of folks in Arizona, at least according to surveys, believe that abortion should be legal, either in all circumstances or in most circumstances, the Arizona legislature doesn't seem to agree. So they are going to be sort of wrestling with this issue over the next few months and trying to figure out, do we repeal the 1864 law? Do we just let the 15-week ban be what we focus on? Do we come up with some entirely new scheme at this point? So there are a lot of moving pieces, and the abortion law in Arizona is going to be in flux for some time to come.
Okay. And you mentioned that, you know, there are multiple states that kind of have these very, very old dormant laws that they're now trying to have to figure out what they're going to do with since the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Are there any other states where you see something like this potentially happening?
Well, I mean, we already have, as you said, we've got a number of states that are already legislating around abortion. Some of them, to be very fair, some of them are actually focused on making sure that they shore up abortion access in their jurisdictions. But in other states, as I said, some already had trigger bans that said, here's what abortion law is going to be as soon as Roe versus Wade disappears. And then you have lots of states, you have Mississippi, you have Georgia, you have Texas, you know, who are creating these gestational bans that start very early in pregnancy, you know, 6 weeks, you know, which is when a lot of people haven't even realized that they're pregnant yet. So basically what Dobbs did is it said to the states, everybody do what you want. And as a consequence of that, we just are living under this incredible patchwork of abortion laws. And then to make it even more confusing, there are so many pieces of litigation that are happening. So even where you have a law that seems to be a clear law, if somebody is suing over that law, then maybe you have a preliminary injunction in place that says that you can't enforce it. So there's just an enormous amount of confusion here, and it's going to stay that way for quite some time. These are not issues that are going to get resolved in the next, you know, couple of months. These are going to be years long projects.
Do you see any of these cases, I guess, making their way up to the U.S. Supreme Court? Because I think, like, some of the people that I've spoken with over the past couple of years, the feeling around Dobbs was that this was sort of the Supreme Court's way of washing its hands of abortion rights as an issue and stuff. But, I mean, they're still taking arguments on mifepristone right now. And so it's something that's, like, it's clearly not over. It's going to keep continuing in one way or the other.
Absolutely. I mean, I did a lot of press when Dobbs was decided. And one of the things that I said in a lot of those interviews was, there's no way that the Supreme Court is getting out of the business of abortion. That's just not going to happen. There are so many issues that need to be resolved, and they're not going to necessarily be resolved on a state level. I mean, just as an example, you know, under Roe and Casey, which was a 1992 very big abortion case, the Supreme Court required that any abortion ban had to have an exception for life and for health. So a bunch of states that are regulating abortion more strictly now, you know, everybody has a life exception, but many of them don't have an exception for health. So we might eventually see a case that winds up at the Supreme Court where an argument is made that you can't have an abortion ban that doesn't have an exception for health in addition to life. So there are lots of questions that remain unresolved. You know, you've had a few states start to think about whether they can somehow control travel for abortion care. That would be a huge issue if a state tried to keep its citizens from traveling elsewhere in order to get legal abortion care. If that happened, that would definitely go up to the US Supreme Court. So, you know, whatever illusion, and quite frankly, our Supreme Court justices are smart people. They had to know that just making the decision in Dobbs was not going to get them out of abortion cases. There were always going to be questions and issues that were going to wind up back in the Supreme Court. And it happened very quickly.
I think it would be good to give ourselves a refresher on what's happening in the challenge to mifepristone currently in the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, I think the estimate is that we'll have a decision on that sometime this summer. And mifepristone, for those who don't know, is one of two pills commonly used in medication abortions. So could you tell me a little bit more about the specific arguments being made in that case?
Sure. So the mifepristone case is hugely important. And in large part, it is hugely important because it's about medication abortion, one of the pills that is used in the two pill regimen for medication abortion. Medication abortions are over 60% of abortions that take place in this country. They only happen in the first trimester, and 90%+ of abortions in this country take place in the first trimester. So if you interfere with access to medication abortion, you are having a huge impact on abortion access throughout the country. So the basic issue in the mifepristone case is folks who are challenging, first they started by challenging the FDA's initial approval of mifepristone. That's off the table. That is no longer a part of the case. They don't get to go all the way back and say that this never should have been approved in the first place. So that is a victory of some sort. But the next parts of the litigation were focused on changes that the FDA made to how mifepristone gets dispensed, to how far into a pregnancy mifepristone can be used, changes to how many visits somebody has to make to a healthcare provider in order to have a medication abortion. So essentially, over the course of time, the FDA had loosened a lot of the restrictions on access to mifepristone. And I think I have to say that many of those restrictions have been deeply criticized, that they were unnecessary from the beginning, so that they should have been those sorts of restrictions, right? People never should have had to go to a healthcare provider, you know, two or three times in order to get access to medication abortion. And so the FDA stripped away a lot of those requirements over time. And so now what the folks who brought the litigation are saying is, okay, we can't go all the way back to the initial approval. That's fine. But we want you to get rid of all of these changes that have happened over time that have made it easier for people to access medication abortion. And so that's what's being argued now. And that's what the Supreme Court is going to decide on. A lot of times, the really controversial decisions, they don't release them until June, right at the end of the term. So that's when we're expecting to see the decision in the mifepristone case.
This case is another example where we see people trying to revive or at least start more discussion around some of these really, really old, what some people might describe zombie laws, like the one in Arizona. But in this case, we specifically heard people talking about the Comstock Act. Could you explain that a little bit for those who don't know?
Yes. So Comstock is basically a law that was created during this period in the United States where there's this huge anti-vice movement. The Comstock is named after the person who created this particular statute and pushed it. And essentially what it is focused on is trying to keep people from having access to things that this guy thought were bad. And one piece of Comstock says that you cannot send anything that can be used for purposes of terminating a pregnancy. You can't send it through the mail. That's the big part of Comstock. And it is not a law that has been enforced for, you know, over a century, I guess, is the right way to say it. And it is not a law that is in any way in keeping with the world that we live in now, And yet it has become very popular for folks who are anti-choice to use Comstock as a way to think about really a nationwide abortion ban. So a way to make it impossible for people certainly to access medication abortion, but also to just make it harder for people to access abortion at all in this country. And in the Mifepristone case, we actually did have at least two of the justices asking questions about Comstock. So it does seem that there is some appetite in the Supreme Court for a Comstock to be relevant in these modern times.
Well, Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us today. You know, is there anything that we haven't touched on that you want to make sure people know?
Well, I mean, I think that the Alabama IVF case is really interesting. It forces people to recognize that the conversation that we have been having as people on the right have worked for years to overturn Roe has never just been a conversation about abortion. You know, abortion is obviously a huge part of it, but for folks who fundamentally believe that life begins at conception, abortion is just a piece of it. And so, you know, in a country where there are anywhere from 400,000 to over a million frozen embryos sitting around in various clinics, et cetera, if those are lives, right, if they are no different than a fetus, if they are no different than a five-year-old, that raises a lot of questions about the fertility industry in the United States and how it has functioned for a very long time. So yes, we have a huge spotlight on abortion right now, but we should not forget that there are other pieces of the puzzle here that would also have significant impact on the kinds of reproductive choices that people get to make in this country.
Kimberly Mutcherson is a professor and former co-dean at Rutgers Law School, where her work has focused on reproductive justice, bioethics, and family and health law. Kimberly, thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you're a frequent listener of NPR, you're probably familiar with our next guest. Sarah McCammon is the network's national political correspondent and co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. For years, she has written about the political, social, and cultural fault lines that crisscross the U.S. In her new book, though, she gets a little more personal. The Exvangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church, covers the political power of the religious right, the disillusionment of LGBTQ people raised in the faith, and her own painful break from the Midwest evangelical church community in which she was raised. WAMC News Director Ian Pickus recently spoke with McCammon to learn more.
In short, an ex-evangelical is someone with an evangelical background who has left that background and re-examined their faith, redefined it in some way. Some people that means coming to no faith at all. Others it means holding a deep faith, but a different one than maybe they started out with. I first came across the term ex-evangelical when I was covering the 2016 campaign and talking to evangelical women who were distressed about the release of the Access Hollywood video in which then-candidate Donald Trump famously bragged about sexual assault. And in talking with these women, one of them said that she'd heard the term ex-evangelical and was talking about the pain of feeling like evangelical was a label that she couldn't carry anymore. And I resonated with that in some ways because while it had been a long time since I would have described myself in that way, I had had my own sort of painful break from my own religious background for different reasons. But I think the reasons that people sort of reexamine their faith background and separate from it are commonalities, whatever the specifics may be. Usually it's a sense of something not adding up, not aligning with your values, and having to make a decision about who you want to be in the world. But with that, there is often a very painful separation from a community of origin and from the people that you love and have loved you. And I've been seeing over the last several years, particularly since 2016, conversations around these themes playing out in online spaces, social media, podcasts, and some books. And it really felt like there had been an escalation of these kinds of conversations around that time. I think in some ways, catalyzed by this moment where white evangelicals were so in the spotlight as they reckoned with the rise of Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's one puzzle that you try to confront in the book, is how a lot of evangelicals made a moral compromise to support Trump's political rise. What kind of role do you see evangelicals playing in this election that we're now in?
A huge role. I mean, I think there was a lot of hand-wringing in 2016 about whether or not, and I did these stories too, would evangelicals support Trump? You know, I remembered, and I write about this in my book, I remembered the reaction by prominent evangelical leaders to then-President Bill Clinton's moral failings in the 1990s. And I think some people expected there would be a similar response to Trump, but he had an R by his name, and he had promised to deliver on evangelical policy goals, like overturning Roe v. Wade. And we saw evangelicals line up behind him. Many of these types of voters would tell me that they had to make a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. It was a binary choice between someone who aligned with their policy goals and someone who didn't. And we saw in 2016 and again in 2020, about 8 in 10 white evangelicals voted for Trump. This time around, in the Republican primary, there was a huge slate of candidates, many of whom, you know, most of whom held essentially the same policy positions, particularly on these sort of moral issues or culture war issues that evangelical voters tend to care about. And still, overwhelmingly, the exit polls from the early caucus states and primary states tell us that white evangelicals once again supported Trump and are arguably instrumental in his being the presumptive nominee at this point. So, and perhaps that's not a surprise. Trump did deliver on a lot of those policy goals, you know, chiefly the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Evangelicals have decided to stick by him, and I think they see him as someone, while he may not, you know, model the kind of character, as some people tell me that they would like to see, they also describe him as someone who will fight for their causes.
So, as you said a moment ago, breaks like the one that you've gone through and others who are chronicled in the book can be very painful because of the loss of family connections. How's your relationship with your family today? Your parents were very true believers, and they raised you in a sort of a very strict household.
I talk about my family in the book, and that was, you know, a difficult decision in some ways to decide what to say and how much to say, but it's impossible to talk about my childhood and my evangelical upbringing without talking about my family. And so I tried to be thoughtful about what I said and the things I've said. Some of them are quite personal and quite painful, but I said the things I think are most salient and the things that echoed themes I've heard from other former evangelicals. And yes, I think for my parents, becoming evangelical or getting saved, as they would have described it, was a pivotal experience in their life. They would say it made them better people. And I think that they wanted to pass that on to me. From my perspective, it was just a different and more challenging, intellectual and spiritual inheritance for me, because one of the things I write about in the book is my grandfather, who was sort of the only non-Christian person I knew well, I grew up just, you know, a few minutes away from his house, but we spent very little time together. And I came to find out later, as I write about in the book, that was because of his sexuality. He had come out late in life as a gay man. And, you know, in the 1980s, at a time when my parents had deeply embraced the evangelical movement and really viewed homosexuality as a sin against God, as an abomination was the word that was used in our church. And so we spent many, many dinner table conversations, many dinner table prayers praying for his soul. And throughout my childhood, I remember worrying about him, worrying that he was going to go to hell, as I was told. And so, you know, for me, accepting the evangelical worldview, it didn't feel peaceful and joyful. It felt very scary. And it felt like something that was dividing me from people that I loved and dividing people that I loved. And so that was a big, that was certainly not the only reason that I moved away from the church, but it was a big factor in forcing me to really examine what I was being told and reckon with it and decide if it resonated with me or not.
So as you write, you have remarried a Jewish man, and you had kind of a unusual ceremony for that wedding. If you don't mind my asking, are you raising your own children with a specific faith today?
So I write in the book, you know, I married a Southern Baptist pastor's kid the first time that I met in my Christian college. We co-parent together very well. We've raised our kids with an awareness of our Christian background and also with as much compassion as possible. At least that's the goal. I've tried to be honest with my children about what I do and don't know, what I can and cannot assert about the world. And, you know, I say in the book, I think there are many, many beautiful things I was taught and that have shaped who I am and informed the way I think, and I'm grateful for those, and I've tried to share those with my children. I also exposed them to their, you know, their Jewish stepfather's faith, which has been really enriching for me as well. I feel like I understand Christianity better, understanding more about where it came from. And yes, we were married in a sort of interfaith ceremony, primarily a Reformed Jewish ceremony under a chuppah, which is not something I ever would have expected as an evangelical girl in Kansas City, but it was beautiful.
Do you expect that you'll get any sort of backlash from your old community with the publication of this book?
Absolutely. I would be shocked if I don't. I've seen the reaction by other women with evangelical ties who have written books not exactly like this, but with, you know, sort of critiques within the family. I think of Jesus and John Wayne by Kristen Copes Dumé, a professor at Calvin, a wonderful book that really, I think, that I cite in my book because it helps provide some of the intellectual infrastructure for what I'm talking about. Beth Allison Barr, professor at, I think, Baylor in Texas, who also wrote a book about gender and evangelicalism and others. You know, it seems that women in particular who speak out and critique the movement, the late Rachel Held Evans, who I write about as well, who wrote so beautifully and honestly about her struggles with spirituality, the backlash is often quite profound and intense. And I don't look forward to it. I don't enjoy that kind of vitriol, but I am not unprepared for it. I will say, I do hope that people within the evangelical world who read this book will listen, and I hope that I'm wrong about that. I hope there won't be a vitriolic backlash, and I understand that people will disagree with some of the things I'm saying and see them differently, but so many younger evangelicals in particular are walking away from their churches or simply shifting their views, and we know firsthand how painful that can be. And I hope that those who remain in the pews will listen and try to understand why and listen with some compassion.
That was NPR political correspondent Sarah McCammon speaking with WAMC's Ian Pickus. McCammon's new book is The Exvangelicals: Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. It's out now through St. Martin's Press. Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Jody Cowan, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at wamcpodcasts.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King from 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, I want a big life, not a house that could have been like. Where are you taking me? Where are you taking me? They said,